All right, everybody. This podcast is sponsored by Manscaped. Join the over 10 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped by going to manscaped.com for 20% off plus free shipping.
Every man knows how scary it can get when going for a close shave below the waist. That's why I trust Manscaped and their lawnmower family of trimmers for all my sensitive areas. When you're down south, only the latest in grooming technology will do. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code THECAST at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code THECAST at manscaped.com.
That's 20% off plus free shipping with the code THECAST at manscaped.com.
For the best your boys have ever looked, people, trust Manscaped.
This is the Pete and Sebastian Show with Pete Corielli and Sebastian Maniscalco.
I feel too close to be losing touch. By giving in, what am I giving up? Am I losing way too much? Hey, California waiting.
Big show here today, Dane. Cook is with us. And listen.
Dane Cook, baby.
So many things I want to get in.
And thank you for inviting me, by the way. I appreciate it.
You got it. Anytime. Now, just a history for our listeners, our viewers. Now, I don't know. Have you ever went out to dinner, had a drink with this man?
Well, I've known him from the city club, so like I played basketball with Dane and a couple of my friends like Robert Kelly and Bill Burr and stuff like grew up seemingly in comedy with Dane.
95-ish, yeah. We were kind of in there.
Wait, you played basketball with him?
Yeah, like pickup basketball ones. Okay. We play hoops and stuff, you know. Dane's the first person, though, I was ever around that, like, when I start comedy, you come across famous people. But he was the first person who was, like, not famous and then was. Yeah. You know, that's a, like, where I actually saw the flower grow. And you're like, oh, wow. Right. I was right there. You know? I never saw it happen before. Like, you know, so it was. And then, you know, because we and you were talking about with the MySpace and all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I've never had the pleasure of playing basketball with you or dinner or what have you. It's been one of these relationships where I've seen you at the club. Hey, what's going on?
Yeah.
Da, 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 da.
It felt like we were in very different graduating classes.
Yeah.
And we kind of hung with our core group. And that just sometimes happens until if you're fortunate enough to reach a level of success, then you have that understanding of like, oh, this is what it's like and the amount of work and responsibility on that side. And I think that's where you earn a little bit more respect with the other graduating class that you may not have, you know, broken bread with.
Yeah. So to take you back, and I don't know what year it was, but I mean, literally, you are the reason for everybody doing what they're doing now on the internet, right? I mean, you were the first guy, you and Tila Tequila, right? Yeah. Do you remember that woman?
Yeah, I actually tried to date her at one point to see if our numbers, I actually did reach out to her at one point. I was like, listen, we're not each other's type. We should hang, seriously. This could be good for business.
But well,
she was like the first person who was zeitgeisting on MySpace for, you know, being kind of, you know, voluptuous and her whole thing.
Yeah, but you used MySpace to promote yourself. And I never asked you this, and I don't know if you've ever got asked this, but did you, like, foresee the future here? Did someone come up to you and go, Dane, what you got to do is you got to get on MySpace and start doing this.
No.
How did this come about?
Well, I don't know if you remember, but, you know, in the city, you know, we'd play ball or something like that, but I grew up an introvert. And so even at the clubs and like during the hang, I could only kind of take so much and then I had to get out of there. And so a lot of my life away from stand-up, but on the road was I was pretty lonely. I was dealing with a lot of anxiety. I loved tech. I was into computers and kind of was like a bit of a nerd in that way. Of
yeah,
like,
I did a few colleges with you and you didn't come out with us. I remember you were like, no, I'm going to eat, I'll see you guys. Yeah,
it,
so
it was, I wanted to. It was hard for me to be participatory because I also grew up non-confrontational. My act seemed very confrontational, but I was very beta and I wasn't like able to hang. I would go home, call my mom, and be like, oh, they all wanted me to hang, but I couldn't breathe. I felt, you know, it was a lot of anxiety I was dealing with. But by way of that, I was online a lot and realizing, oh, wow, a lot of these colleges that we're doing at the end of the night when I go, hey, I'm on, you guys on MySpace? And like 10 people would clap. I'd be like, you should go home and sign up on that. I'll do a meet and greet on there later. And I started realizing over the course of like maybe 98, 99, like, oh, no, the industry doesn't give a shit about me. Nobody is, I'm not getting callbacks or anything. And, or we already have, you know, we already have a Jim Carrey or we have a type like you. And I was finding that just through those hours where I wasn't spending hanging at the clubs, I was finding my fans online.
So did you always have this anxiety of hanging out with people, even as a small kid?
I did.
Were you eating lunch alone and shit like that?
I was, yeah. I would, even in high school, I would take my lunch and I would go to the theater. There was like a little back entry way that my mentor and drama instructor, Frank Roberts, God rest his soul, he would say, hey, if you're nervous during lunch, go in and eat. I'd eat on stage. I'd set up a prop table and I'd eat by myself and I'd, you know, think about characters and think a lot about stand up. You know, I'd sometimes stand up there and kind of practice. Like, if I could get in front of a crowd of people, what would I want to do? And so, yeah, I really was, I'm not sound maudlin, but I was kind of like that lonely kid. And it took about 10 years into comedy before I finally found my comfort zone.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
Hilarious shit.
No, well, no, aspects.
This is.
I feel like sometimes what he's saying, I'm like relating to.
I know. Well, yeah, you used to go home for lunch and watch Three's Company.
Yeah, I didn't stick around at lunchtime. I went home and watched Three's Company and ate lunch alone and then went back to school because I didn't want to eat lunch or I was a little bit shy and whatnot.
Yeah,
and
introverted
myself. So when you're speaking that, I'm like, all right, this is extremely relatable. Now,
would you get that thing too, where it was like when you were home, you felt great.
Oh God, I felt great.
Yeah, I'm still like that.
Yeah, it's like I'm a homebody now. Everybody's like, yeah, come on out. I'm like, yeah. Even my wife is very outgoing, wants to hang around people. Not that I don't like people. It's just that sometimes I feel I don't know. Is this interesting what I'm saying? I don't know. It's just a whole thing.
Safety.
I just love it.
Not even laying on the couch, just being on your couch.
That's it.
With Three's Company, especially.
Except the hug from your family. There's nothing better.
John Ritter was a huge, massive inspiration to me. Yeah. Physical, shtick and stuff like that. So it really was like the meet and greet online and meeting people through, MySpace, through the internet. Well, then finally it was like, well, these people now want to meet me at the shows. And so I would do a meet and greet almost like a little bit like I would have to kind of like still be that guy, pull you in and be like, it was a little bit of that. And then the minute I'd get out of there, I'd be like, and this breath would come out of me.
Oh, wow.
It was hard, man.
Playing a character for a long time.
But it was like, that's what made me a better comic. Cause I went, I love Dice. Dice is a good friend of mine. But I was like, if I'm a character, then that means that I have to always have kind of a put on. If I can get funny as myself and as the person who feels these feelings, then I can just be that Boston guy who's like, dude, shut the fuck up. Come on, take a picture. I don't have to do a put on. Mm-hmm. I could just be myself. And so that was the ultimate goal in comedy, was get that good at comedy so that it's showmanship, but it's still me. So I don't have to fake it and feel like a phony person.
Right.
So where do you see this, that this is paying off now with the MySpace? Are you seeing like, oh shit, people are coming to the shows?
Yeah.
And while this is happening, don't you feel like you almost, you have like a secret that nobody else has? Because nobody else was doing this shit.
Yeah.
I found out about it. What the fuck's he doing?
Yeah.
MySpace, what? Yeah. And then I felt like everybody was kind of trying to play catch up.
But I wasn't like keeping it to myself, because I would go into I was at the factory a lot or the store, and I'd go in and I would tell people, I'd be like, you should start this thing, because it's obviously like the equivalent of like a great mailing list. I didn't know it was going to be social media to the place where that would be the center point of how we communicate like today. But at the time, no, I wasn't like Joe Rogan was already on. Joe had a great website, and Joe and I were both building up a website, and he took one path originally and I took another. His path was he built up like a forum and a chat area, and he kind of hung in there with his fans. I took my website to MySpace and I kind of went out. Uh-huh. And so it was interesting to go like, oh, my way of reaching out at that point was really putting me in the zeitgeist and finding colleges or gigs.
Yeah.
But Joe was building up a fan base through his messaging, through his way. And so it was kind of interesting to look back on that and go, it worked for both of us for what we needed at that time in our lives and careers.
Talk about websites.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you remember this, but I do.
Okay.
I'd go to your website, right? I wasn't touring. I was working at the Four Seasons. I go, let's see this guy's doing on his website. You had a map of the country, right?
Yeah.
And you had pins
Do you remember this?
Yeah, a little orange line to every pin.
And if you clicked
Indiana
on the
Jones pin,
if you clicked on the pin, and then like a thing would
thing
pop
would open.
Up. Yeah, and it would be like the theater or the arena that you were playing.
Right. Yeah,
it was, I'm like, what? Oh my god!
Google Maps stole from you.
It was.
Holy shit, bro.
It was like, it really was a, I mean, first of all, I spent everything I had on that damn website. Everything I'd saved in 98, I was worth $38,000. Like, that's it, front to end. I put $37,000 into that fucking wow. website to go, can a thing pop up? And it's me with the hair and the, and he was like, all right, that's going to be $5,000 and it's going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I dumped everything I had into that. But it was like, that idea coupled with the hang of social media. Yeah. That's what was so different from today. Now they expect it. You know, I want to talk to Justin Bieber. I want it. But back then, it was a weird thing for somebody to write you and go, I just saw you at my college. And then I write back and be like, yeah, what's up, Becky? What's going on?
Wow.
And then suddenly 10 people are around them going, he's talking to you. What? And then when I come back, they bring the whole gang. You know, it's like, it was really like I was discovering it at the same time. I like to think I was smarter than I was, but truly it was just me night after night being like, this is the only people that seem to care about the shows that I'm doing, so I might as well keep talking to them.
First of all, this is so fascinating on a couple of different levels. And the big thing here is, and put this in the back pocket, what more I want to say, but there should be a movie about what you did because you were the first social media person, as we've been discussing, to do this kind of thing. Like when TV came out and you only had Milton Berle, right? Like, so you, by the time I saw your special, and I know you, right, but like not well, and then you were getting so famous, you were barely ever around, you did the theater in the round. And it was the first time I ever saw someone do stand-up where I'm watching on TV, and I'm like, oh my God, they'll walk off a cliff with this guy right now. This is some John, what's the Kool-Aid guy I always forget?
Oh, Jim Jones.
This is Jim Jones shit right here. I mean, you're doing a lean-in, you guys. And they go, what? What? I'm like, what? Like, it was you rolling a treehouse together. Like, you climbed the rope to get the fuck up there together. I never, like, they would have walked off with you. And so it was like this clubhouse thing that, like, the way they've made a movie about Facebook and the way they make a movie, like, this should, it should be a movie because it is the most important thing as a comic now, other than your actual act.
So, like, the Social Network, but the MySpace version with me and Tila Tequila.
Right. I mean, it starts out with a voiceover.
This sounds like a fucking hit.
In 98, I made $37,000. I put $36,000 into the thing, and I bought food. You know, and then...
And wait, can Matt Rife play me?
Who else would? This is the Irish spelling of social media.
He's the Taylor Swift of social media right now, man.
Oh, yes, yes.
And you know, at 15 years old, he saw my show. He came to Nationwide Arena. He wrote me at 15, Matt Rife, and said, I want to be a comedian. I said, graduate high school and come out to L.A. I'll be sitting upstairs at the Laugh Factory in one of the leopard print booths. And sure enough, like 2 years later, he came with his grandfather. He's like, I'm a little early, but I go back, graduate. And I said, and then I'll help you. And so I knew Matt from 15 up. We kept in touch, emails, phone calls, then years later brought him on the road with me. And
oh my God, really?
I got to tell you, like, the funniest thing about what Rife is doing is I took him to Runyon Canyon one day. This is like 5 years ago. I go, you got to get on social media. And he was like, no, that's not going to be my path. That's not my thing. And he was so anti-social media. And I was like, I think it would work for you, man. I really think, you know, people want to know you. You should build. And what he did, of course, he did entirely on his own. But it was that idea of, like, lean into that, man, and let people get to know you in that other way. And now, holy
shit. That's the end of the movie.
That's the end of the movie. No, this is the end of the movie. But who plays you guys is the fucking question.
Oh, my God.
Maniscalco's in it because he can get the fee.
But a passing of the torch on Runyon Canyon. Rife goes this way,
as the old bull literally on the hill. But literally fucking saying to that kid, like, hey, dude, like, just embrace all of it and don't be afraid to, you know, share whatever. But I didn't think what he did and how he pocketed that is really incredible. I mean, that's a testament to, like, how he saw You know, he took what I did and he took it to a place I couldn't have even imagined. So, I mean, more power to him.
What do you think of the internet today and social media? I mean, you were there in the beginning. Now you're on it now. Do you like it now? Do you like it better when it was just MySpace and you had this intimate relationship? Now it seems like really, really hard to communicate with fans at a level where it seems personal.
It's, you know, everything's different. The algorithm, the monetization, I was in the wild west of it. It was real simple. It's like if something zeitgeist, it went everywhere. And you literally was like the next day. I remember I would wake up sometimes in the middle of the night just giddy to get online and see, like, first of all, how many CDs did I sell? And I was the fulfillment center. So I was boxing those things myself in the middle of the night. But it was also that thing of like, I'm seeing the data. You don't get the data today. Most streamers don't want to share a lot of info. So I had all the info. I could see where I should tour, where I shouldn't, where I was killing it, what gender, what, you know, early retention rates for me, who's dipping into the website, all that. Whereas today, what's different is, unfortunately, like, if your numbers are great on social media, that could probably get you in a lot of doors. But once you're in the doors, it's that thing of like, you're giving your IP to somebody who probably doesn't want to give you data. And it's a simple equation. They don't want you to leverage, because if you know what you're really doing, you get a, you know, better deal. I guarantee you've been in some pretty hinky, transactional situations with the level of, you know, the echelon you've reached. Why can't I know that? I'd like a little bit. Helps me to know. Me to bring business back to you. So I think in that regard, you know, as an artist, you have to like be more careful about where you share your content and kind of who you, you know, give it to. But I also feel like it's a day and age where I'm 33 years into stand-up now. My whole philosophy, I don't even really like to call my audience an audience or fans. It's the culture has changed. And if you don't change with it, you're going to pretty quickly feel very distant from other performers that will continue to maintain at 50, 60, 70. And the key to that, I think, is inclusion and really allowing yourself to understand they all have something to push too. They're not thinking like an audience 20 years ago. I buy a ticket and I just sit and I watch the show. They are the show. Their life is also a show. Their tutorial, their farming business, they want to feel like they're getting something out of even showing that they're at your show, because that's helping their communicado with their fans and their network. So
when they're taking their phones out and they're doing their thing, I'm going, this ain't your thing.
Right?
It is that thing. A
20-year-old today doesn't want to go, let's say a movie theater, and say, oh, turn off the phone and 2 hours in the dark. They literally don't fucking understand that. So there's either going to be a new movie theater for a 20-year-old where the experience is, this is where we all go and we all do watch and we're all on the thing because we are the experience. We're the reason this movie's being made. And culturally, they know that. It's just, that's in our DNA. So you have to think like that. And I think that makes me communicate with my audience in some ways very differently online. And also, where I don't want to be online now and where I kind of want to pull back and go like, oh, when I have something to share, then it's probably a better time. The algorithm, you know, will buck with you. But if you try to hold it the whole time, it's like, pay us So it is tricky, man. It's a different landscape. I still love it.
Listen, guys, when it comes to Manscaped, I doubt Pete Corielli has ever shaved anything on his body except for his beard, all right? So he ain't reading these ads. As far as I'm concerned, I've touched every part of my body with a razor blade and a razor. And I got to tell you, this product, Manscaped, is far above the rest. Every man knows how scary it could get when you're going for a really close shave below the waist. Believe me, I've cut it a few times. There's been blood on the bathroom floor. That's why I trust Manscaped for all my sensitive areas. Join the 10 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped by going to manscaped.com and use the code THECAST for 20% off and free shipping. Manscaped and their lawnmower family of trimmers are reinventing the world of personal grooming. Their cutting-edge technology reduced the risk of ingrown hairs and grooming accidents, so you never have to be nervous when grooming down south. Let's be honest, people. guys, when you take off your pants, you don't want three or four bumps down there when you're going into battle, all right? They sell grooming products for all sorts. They like to focus on ball trimming, but up to you if you do.
It's not just for below the waist, too. I personally like the beard hedger. Oh, man, it trims my beard nice. You're never going to see my face again. I've made that decision. I don't look good clean shaven. And Manscaped has finally given me a beard trimmer that I can use comfortably, confidently. And when I use it, I don't have to worry about a pinch. Everything is level. Manscaped has you covered, man.
Guys, it's waterproof. How many times are you shaving on, I don't know, your bathroom floor, a hotel room, and you got hair all over the floor, and then your wife walks in and it looks like somebody shaved a raccoon? No, not with Manscaped. Take it into the shower with you guys.
They have LED lighting. They have a travel case so you can bring this stuff where you're going.
Manscaped has everything you require for your grooming needs with a full collection of products from body wash to deodorant to nail trimmers. This right here is on the cutting edge of cutting. Upgrade your trimmer and your life will follow. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code THECAST at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code THECAST at manscaped.com. For the best your boys have ever looked, people, trust Manscaped.
You can't get wrap his head around it.
But I can.
No, but I'm saying he's tech.
This concept I can. Dane is like
it,
so.
It really is the philosophy
he's
of it.
He's embracing the narcissism of today's youth. You are, though. You're like, I realize
that's
you guys
book.
Are part of the show, so I'm going to let you be part of the show. You know, what they're doing at your show, you should be grateful that they see you as worthy of...
My audience don't even know how to fucking put the video camera.
Oh, man. No, but that's another take on it, too. And that's how, where I'm saying, whatever fans I have, I feel like we'll all die together. You're trying to get the youth of today with what you're like...
But I, like, it's amazing to see what you've accomplished, the industry that you've created just by being genuinely funny. You're a genuinely funny guy.
Oh, thank
and
you.
Where your business, I don't know you that way, but I'd like to understand even more the way you kind of cohabitate with, you know, the business side of things, but kind of just bringing it back to like the brass tacks of it is like, I've grown up with a generation of comedy fans that from the colleges we did, now they bring their kids to my show. And even their parents that didn't want them to listen to me in the first place, they now come to my show. So I'm hitting a stride, back in a stride of like, and I've been seeing it since COVID of like, I got like three generations and they're coming for different reasons. It's not just because I'm bombastically funny in my moment. It's like, oh no, Dane's always been consistent. He was back then. My daughter saw him in Employee of the Month. Doesn't know he's a stand-up. They come thinking they're just going to see Zach the Box Boy. Doesn't know this is my real fucking job. Then they leave going, and that's my biggest kick. I like people to leave and go, I didn't know it was going to be that good. I knew it'd be fun or funny.
Yeah.
But I still want people to leave and go, damn, I want to come back and see what the fuck is happening next. So that's where I am with the audience that's out there is like, they're all in various stages of their life and different reasoning for coming and seeing the show now, you know?
Yeah.
So are you a type of guy, like, do you have a vision board?
I thought you were going to sing that likes to roam around. It looked like you were going into a, because I'm the kind of guy likes to roam around in the town. In Madison Square Garden, nine times in a row.
What I'm saying is, are you a wanderer?
No.
By the way, how does that feel? How does that feel, man, to be at the center of the stage of the world? I know how I felt, but dude, you're doing it in a way that's beyond what I even anticipated. How does that feel right now?
Did you? You know what? I don't enjoy the moment. I have a problem with
when you're in it.
I'm always looking for, okay, like, what's next? That's the last time I did Madison Square Garden, I didn't really enjoy it because I was like, okay, you know, what are we doing next?
Right.
I'm taking some time now to smell the roses and enjoy this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you know, like, I don't know, next time I might not be able to sell Madison Square Garden, you know? So I'm really kind of taking it in.
Hey, let me give you the worst advice ever. Enjoy it. I sat with Steve Martin about 7 years ago. I met him briefly with Lorne Michaels once at the comic strip. Lorne Michaels came to see me when I was getting ready to host the second time, and he surprised me by bringing Steve Martin to the show. Which, talk about like my anxiety going, I'm trying to like be cool, but like, I'm like, damn, dude, this is the guy that really gave me a lot of incentive and belief and just, and so I kept in touch with him and then sent me his book, Born Standing Up. And then I said, can I take you to lunch? I sat and I think like, this is my Yoda. We're going to be sitting here and it's going to be just firing off. And he said, I never enjoyed it. I said, ever? I go, I love it. And he goes, I didn't love any of it. I go, but what about the whole lunch? I'm like, but when you did the thing, he goes, I couldn't wait to do a crossword puzzle back in my hotel room. and let me tell you, Sebastian, I think the minute he saw one empty seat, he went, I'm done. I'm fucking done. I'm out. And he said, I dipped out the minute I saw an empty seat. Wow. And it was it. I go, you're telling me that you didn't enjoy one. And so, last thing I'll say about this, and Steve Martin, because I think he wrote an article. It's 4 pages for the New Yorker. It's called Letter to My Father. It'll break your heart. It's not really funny, but it's super poignant. And I'm not going to give it away, but what he says in the last paragraph, text me after and tell me if it changes your mind or your life, just even like that much.
No.
Because you deserve all the, man, it's amazing.
Well, I appreciate it. I don't want to say that.
Back to me, though. I'm the guest. I need the clicks.
You should be doing guest speaking at UCLA and social media.
Dude, I've been doing back channel seminars and I do all that stuff. I just don't put it out there a lot because I don't want to, you know, muddy the waters of stand up. Is my, you know, that's my job. But I do go on. I love talking shop, man, philosophy, and I like inspiring people of any age to fucking not. My dad used to say, "Tomorrow's the first day of the rest of your life." Yeah. And I live my whole life like that, through thick and thin, good times, bad times. I've taken hits. I've had years where I'm the cream of the crop, and I wake up the same way every day. Like, I just want to enjoy it, appreciate it. You know,
that's a great, good great, attitude, great advice. My question was, are you the type like to write your goals? Like, I want to do arenas. I want to do this, or does it just happen to you? Are you foreseeing like? Do you like, oh, I want to do Madison Square Garden. I want to be in movies. Or did you just
then?
Like,
I did. Yeah.
Then you did.
Yeah. For me, then it was like when I saw the numbers going up and I was playing colleges, I hit Penn State one night and it was the night that changed my life. They said, oh, we're going to move it from the blah, blah, blah to the field house because we thought it was going to be 4,000, 13,000.
Oh, so nice. That,
I was filming Torgasm with Bobby Kelly and Gary Gulman. And I went in, I was like, oh, shit. Okay. This is it. I'm literally turning the corner. Right here, and in that moment, my sister had seen Steve Martin actually at Madison Square Garden, and I was like, "That's where I'm taking this. I'm not stopping until I get to perform there." And to me, like that was, and today the way like my goals are today is that very different. That was probably like just being, you know, ballsy, but also like being so scared as a kid, being like, "I'll show everybody what I'm capable of, but I'll show myself." Today, it's like I'm very more deliberate in the things that I want to do and the things that excite me, you know, my wife and I, and like the way we kind of game plan things out. So they're maybe not as big a swings as like, I got to play the biggest arena in the world.
Yeah.
But they're personal and meaningful. And I get just as excited to get those done as something massive like that.
Got it.
I'm down.
Yeah. You want to do Gillette Stadium next summer? Hey, dude, no, I think together 80% of the tickets probably come in from you, but.
Boom.
We do an open air a stadium right after the Patriots game.
I'm dying to know if Steve Martin went with a salad or a sandwich.
He went with the salad, actually.
I had a feeling he would.
He went with the salad.
Doesn't seem like he'd eat meat.
He gave me his banjo. We sat down, he gave me a banjo CD, and he goes, this is my group, the you know, I do banjo music.
You know, you said he gave me his banjo, and then you paused and said he gave me his banjo CD. Way less cool. I mean, if he hit the banjo, I'd be like, you fucking give you a banjo over a salad? Holy shit.
I didn't want to finish the story. This is like when you get a laugh by mistake on stage, and you're like, fuck it, I'm leaving on that. Thanks, guys. Yeah. Sorry, I'm gonna dip out. Halfway during a big, you're like, that's the laugh. Fuck it, I'm done.
Talking about your wife. I have a wife who's younger than me, and you have a wife that's younger than you. Do you feel like, I mean, and you look like you're like pretty fucking, I mean, you're big.
Dude, yeah. I'm feeling good, man. Yeah.
Is this, find it hard to keep up with a younger woman? Because for me, I
if your wife was my age, would you be not huge? Is that what you're trying to get at?
Yeah. That's just saying, like, you know, like when we're hiking, when we're freaking hiking, she's ahead of me, and I'm like, hold on.
My wife is a Pilates instructor, certified, but she is in bed at 8 o'clock at night. She doesn't fucking understand the energy that I have because of 30 years doing it. If I have a night off at 10 o'clock at night, suddenly I'm on. And she's like, where is this energy? And I go, because my whole life I had to be ready for the second show. So I do my best work. I've always been energetic. My wife, like, I mean, honestly, I think it's the perfect pairing, because even though she's younger, she calls herself the old lady because she's just that. Yeah. She's just like, I can't keep up.
So you work out a lot then at night? Is that what you're saying?
I do. Yeah. I mean, I'll get on the, I have one of those treads and one of those little ones you can put under your desk, and I'll get on there and I'll just, you know, be on the computer and, you know, trying to figure shit out and whatever it is, usually like late at night if I'm not, or even after a gig. I used to go home and do MySpace 20 years ago. Now I get home and I'm like, all right, let me catch up on all my, you know, news of the day and, you know, people I get an email or whatever. So, night owl.
The organization. I'm in my backyard half the time doing one-hit spray myself and coming in to catch the second half of Housewives. Everybody else, I come home, that's when I get my news done. You have a news time.
Yeah.
I mean, who has a news time? It's time for my news. So organized, Dane. I learned from this, young comics, the organization.
Yeah, it seems very, very deliberate, very methodical. Yeah. There's a plan of action.
Like, with you, like, through the years, like, all of a sudden, you'll go through a phase where I'll get a text that, like, Jesus Christ, was he in the army? Like, fucking,
I got kids, I gotta get up early to get shit done. Because once they get up, it's your day's over. So what is the key, Dane? Is it a lot of caffeine? Is it healthy eating? I'm on C4s trying to get through the fucking day. What are you just alive constantly?
I think so. I've never had coffee in my life. I've been most except for sex. I guess I'm straight edge because I've never had a drink. I've never had any drugs at all.
Drink of alcohol?
I've never had a sip of alcohol. I've never done any drug ever. Nothing. Oh, I barely take a
I did both
Tylenol
of those things
if I need
in the last
to. I believe this. I believe this to be true. Like, fucking Goofus and Gallant are sitting here.
Oh my god. Oh, there you are. What do you have? So liquid carrot. I was at Whole Foods with these guys today, and they're yelling out celery juice. Who got the celery juice? That you would slide in and grab that, right?
I eat well. My dad was an athlete. All the men from the cook side, they were all just like doers. They all fucking built like I did Ancestry, and everybody's like built railroads, built, you know, construction, sports, and so I just think I have that thing in me, man, where I'm fortunate. I got good energy and that's it.
The no alcohol thing, I'm fascinated with. Is that something that is just a choice? Like, I'm not doing alcohol, or do you see that in your family or friends somewhere? And go, I don't want to be that. Where does the resiliency is just amazing that you haven't had a sip, but people look at swine, right? And you're like, fuck, man.
Well, my dad drank, and he drank to excess, and my dad definitely, you know, dealt with alcoholism. He was a brilliant guy, and he had a lot of natural ability, but he was also a BC graduate, and he was business minded. And I would watch this guy who was so I would watch this guy who was so he would get so excited about, like, especially things promotional wise. He always had business. He had a lumber business. He had a insulation, like winter. What are those windows in the winter? The storm windows that you'd install. Oh. I forget what those used to be on the East Coast. Everybody had the weatherproofed. And my dad was the kind of guy that I'd walk home from junior high school. His office was on the way home. He'd be in the window already, like, come here. He'd be excited. I go, what? And he'd go, look at my sign. Mr. Window is the name of it. He goes, Mr. Window, you look at my sign. He goes, I painted it. I go, okay. And he goes, now come outside. And he'd bring me out to Massachusetts Avenue. He goes, look at all the other signs. Look at every fucking sign on here, Dane. I go, okay. And he goes, what do you see? And I go, it's a bunch of signs. He goes, blue and white, blue and white, blue and white. Mine's orange and white. And he was so excited. The business went to shit. He was terrible at selling windows. But he loved what I liked about the era of building my audience. He liked figuring out that that was different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it might catch some eyes. And like I said, he would say, tomorrow's the first day of the rest of your life. Or he'd say, nothing attracts a crowd like a crowd. And he was just always, and I think if he didn't drink, he would have taken his career in many different facets further. So when you asked me that, for years, I'd say, no, I just don't drink. But as I got a little older, I realized, I think I just didn't want to admit, I didn't want to be the worst parts of my father.
Yeah. Interesting.
You know? Wow. And so, but I'm going to start doing everything at like 60. Heroin, fucking meth.
You don't like any of it.
Crank. I don't even know what crank is, but I'm going to crank. I'm going to fucking just, I mean, why not, right? Yeah. 60, 70, just fucking go for it at that point. I bet your body's like, all right, this is good. This makes me want to live another 40 years to keep imbibing in this. No? Okay, whatever.
The only thing I think maybe down the line, if you were going to try some, it's maybe a hit here and there, but like drinking, if you haven't needed to know, okay, you're having a great time, why bother? You know, good for you, man. That's really awesome. Again, that should be part of the speech at UCLA during the summer.
Or the movie that we're going to make. We're producing this, right? Isn't that what you said earlier?
It's got a lot of stuff you can learn from for young comics. Yeah, you know?
Absolutely. Well, everybody's like getting blasted and you know, right, doing whatever they're doing. You know, this guy's going home and reading the news. I mean,
I know. Yeah. Really. So, did you catch that he said he's on a treadmill while he's on the?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we let that go. We let that go.
It's $200 on Amazon.
Oh, I clocked it. I'm like, Lana, get a fucking treadmill over here.
I'm sending you the link today when I get home. God. You're gonna love it.
Hidden me,
yeah,
man.
No, this thing's amazing. 500 calorie burn in 28 minutes if you're brisk.
Jesus Christ.
But yeah, but whatever you're doing up here, you really feel you're focused, or you're not typing going, oh my God, we're having a fucking heart attack right now.
No.
Like, you really?
Yeah, man. I'm dialed in. It's like, I've always.
Have you ever hung out with Tony Robbins? Because he would be like, pump the brakes.
You gotta slow down.
He would. He'd be like, Dave, relax.
We do have something we do on this show. We ask celebrities, have they ever crossed paths with Tom Cruise? Have you ever?
Oh,
have
he
you,
probably has.
I have.
And is he as
have you?
No.
Okay.
We have yet to come across this guy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
If you could tell it.
Okay. It's a physical. Can I?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm at a party one night, I don't know what I'm at, but so, you know, one of those things where it's like, you feel like you have to go. And so my agent, you're going to be me, and I'll be Tom Cruise.
Right.
My agent goes, you want to meet Tom Cruise? In my whole life and career, barely ever do I. I'm not a. I meet people. We meet people. I don't get nervous. I've always been. I've met some pretty great people. You're like, oh, I'm a fan. The only time I ever got nervous in my life was in 1992. I was 2 years into my comedy career, and I was at Kiss 108 radio station, and I was waiting to like promote my Boston whatever local dates, and they would have you on the radio. Maddie in the Morning would have you on the radio, and the elevator doors opened, and a group of people came out that were very familiar, but not at all familiar. And it took me a few seconds that morning at like 7 a.m. And it was all the kids from Willy Wonka, the movie.
Oh, my God.
Grown up. Charlie Bucket, Veruca Salt, Violet Beauregard, Augustus Gloop, Mike TV, all walked out. And the head Oompa Loompa. All walked out. And I'm like, you kind of look like old fucking people that I know from my youth. That... I have a picture of that in my office. I don't have some of the other names that I won't name. And, you know, and I'm like this, like. But he goes, do you want to meet Tom Cruise? And my balls got tight. Oh. My fucking, and I have an undescended testicle. When I was a kid, I had the left one is like fucking dormant.
God. Don't tell my me Tom made it come out.
My right ball is like the fucking worker. But my left one is like, it's an ornament. It's petite. It's there. And it's kind of like you just want to wave at it and let it do its thing. That one fucking went in me. That one fucking literally went in my pelvis and fucking disappeared.
Oh my.
I was like, I would like to meet Tom Cruise. He walks me over. I don't remember the initial way that he, you know, got Tom's attention, but Tom turned to me and he went like this. He went, and this is exactly what he said, quote unquote. So please put out your hand like you're going to shake. He goes,
oh,
I'm very pleased to meet you. I'm very pleased. And then he cast me out. Like the same way he pulled me in, he actually, like, the hand was like, and now you go. And I did.
Metaphor it.
I think, Sebastian, I think I'm still fucking going backwards. I'm not even kidding.
Oh my God.
I'm very pleased. And he looked, and he was right in.
Oh my God, bro! Like I can feel it. I can feel it. Oh God, I give anything for that.
I thought he was gonna take my arm off. Yeah, very pleased.
Take it, Tom.
Very pleased to meet you. Yeah. And then one more. Very pleased.
Do the fade.
And then he yeah. And then he went like this, and he let me go, and it was like you're out.
Slowly go back.
And I was like, and I fucking woke up in my bed like this. Ah, risky business. I don't know what I said. It was epic. I'm very pleased. I'm very pleased to meet you. Oh, I'm very shit. Pleased.
That is unbelievable.
And it was a life changing. I went home. I literally was like, I'm fucking out of here. I'm going home. I don't want to meet Seth fucking McFarlane.
Oh my God.
I heard he's not very nice.
Oh man. I don't even think it was the Facebook. I think it was the shake from Tom Cruise that made the career.
But it was this. It was the grab, and you know he's a little small. I'm 6'1". But suddenly it was like it was amazing, man. Wow. All that stuff you hear about him when it's like, it's dude, Tom locks in on you, and you're like, okay, this is all embellished. No, for real. That's exactly how it felt. That whole experience. It was like the minute he turned, I was the only person in the room, and it was that whole thing. Bro. Oh, it's beautiful. It was like sex. I think I had sex with him. I think it was the hand. That was some sex. That was some foreplay. Wow. I think the pulling was almost like You know what I mean? The aesthetic of.
It's like some of these stories about Tom Cruise, it's like, you know, you don't want to say you believe in like Bigfoot, but when people keep describing him the same way, you know what I'm saying? I mean, every story is this magnetic. You become the only one in the room. And wow.
Yeah.
Now, were you left like, is he might call me any day to do something? Because, I mean, you know, why would he do that?
I left like breathless, when you hear like a woman's romance novel on a beach and your girl's like, oh, it's breathless. I'm breathless. And it's like, I guess that's how I felt. Because when I left that moment, I called everybody and tried to explain, like, this is how I felt like I was in his orbit. Right. I felt important. I felt like he was going to be like, we're going to talk. We're friends.
Right.
We're going to. But when he did that thing, and I used that. That was something that I kind of like tried to be like, all right, there is a way to kind of, in a nice way, please leave me be at this point. And I was like, it was absolutely unbelievable. He was like a superhero in real life.
Yeah.
Wow. That's Tom Cruise. That's very pleased.
Really
is. Very pleased to meet you. Very pleased. Fucking amazing. But here's the best part. I don't know if he fucking knew who I was. I don't know if he might have had no idea. But if you think about the verbiage of that, it's so perfect because it really is so kind of like, it's disguised. It's not like he knew something and he said, I like the thing that you did about that. It was just like, I know how to make this person feel good because they're meeting me. I don't know who the fuck Dane Cook is. And then I'm just going to release him into the wild and let him feel like for 1.5 seconds that like it was meaningful to me.
Yeah.
And that's what he's great at.
Shit. Okay. So pandemic hits, right? Are you the type of guy that has to get up on stage weekly? Do you take bits off or do you got to consistently be up there doing it?
No, I took some time off. I was definitely like, felt like it was a good moment to sort of like even just not only recalibrate. I was falling in love, you know, my now wife. It's like, so in that time, it was kind of good because we learned from that time that like we absolutely belong together. And then there were other things that I was putting off in my own life, both creatively and even some personal things. And I just took that 2-year period to really like, you know, close some chapters and, you know, people in my life that I missed and reached out to and other things that I needed to kind of take some ownership on that, like maybe earlier in my career, you know, where you missteps and fuck ups or, you know, even after my parents passed away, it was like, I went through a couple of years. I was not easy to be around.
Yeah.
I already dealt with my own kind of anxiety. Now I'm grieving. I don't know how to fucking do that. I just want to make people laugh. I don't want to be upset and sad. I'm fighting it. So I did kind of take that time to like sweep my side of the street and then prepare for success, man. Prepare for what does it mean to be I'm the happiest and healthiest I've ever been personally and professionally now.
Nice.
And in the past, nice. Like 5 years, ever.
Right.
I never had really both happening at the same, planning our family, talking about how we want to, you know, where we want to live. Like the next bunch of years of my life, like I'm excited I did what I did over a tough time through COVID because it prepared me for today.
Yeah. So no drive-ins, huh? You didn't play any drive-ins?
I didn't do the, I did a couple gigs.
So do you see yourself moving out of California? Is this the place you're going to kind of settle down and raise a family?
I never thought I would even have stayed. I came out in 98. I thought I'd be here for a few months. I was on a TV show that nobody saw with Betty White. I was her grandson on a show with Marie Osmond, played my mom. And I did this show for 1 year and I thought, all right.
Donny Osmond's sister?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, which was so weird. I grew up watching Betty White and everything, and of course, like Donnie and Marie when I was a kid. And suddenly, I'm on this show on ABC.
How old were
you out here?
28 or yeah. I did the San Francisco Comedy Contest. The producers happened to see me in San Fran, took a meeting, said, "Do you do TV or whatever?" I was like, "I've done some plays. I do stand up." They gave me a shot. It was called Maybe This Time. I see your guy pulling it up right over there, and ended up coming down here and thinking, oh, I'm just going to leave and go back east, you know, as soon as I'm done with my obligations here. And then I ended up staying. And so it wasn't until probably the last couple of years that I started thinking with my wife, like, I actually think I'm ready to be somewhere else, you know? Yeah, I've always wanted to build a house. That's something I've always dreamt of doing. So I've saved over the years and been like, I want to build a beautiful home somewhere. So I don't know where yet, but I do see myself probably, you know, being here less than I was for a lot of years.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at this. I didn't think I emphasized well enough. I had a crush on Marie Osmond. She's fantastic, right? So like, does she ever like when you're doing that? Would she be like hanging out like, ah, fuck? Or is she never? No. She sticks to
her and Betty. Betty liked dirty jokes though. Betty would tell some pretty, you know, salacious. She had a good sense of humor, but no, Marie was like, weren't they Mormon?
I think that's what I'm saying. No. I was on the one that like, she's not off to the side. Oh shit, we got
no,
Marie.
No. If she just hung up, she went, fucking Donnie. Yeah. Let's go. Bring the kid in with the fucking mullet. Where's Betty? Golden bitch. Right? No, she was the most, like the sweetest. I'm sorry. Right. If she's seen that, she's like, oh my God.
And you know, it's like, this isn't funny to say, but like, sorry about your parents. I lost both of my parents over the past few years too. So I know what it's like, right? But I also feel
you lost
like
both of your, I'm sorry.
Yeah, at separate times, but over the past couple of years. But like, I also feel a sense of selfishness, right? Like where I'm running out of time, so I can't sit around and be sad about my parents being gone. I think about my dad, right? So let's all think about our dads. And you think about when your dad's dad died. I can't remember my dad. I know my dad loved his dad.
Yeah.
But I don't remember him being sad. So it makes me wonder, like, growing up, like, I don't remember my dad.
But that era, Pete, was like.
But did my dad go, good night, son, and then grab a scotch and in another room?
I don't know your dad.
No, but I'm saying.
Okay? If you're looking for me, I'm not a soothsayer. I can't tell you. I'm just here to cut up some stories about back in the day. And
but, you know.
No, but.
It's like you say.
They were different, man. They fucking, you know, my dad, same thing. Or he'd be like, yeah, I'm sad about it. You know, like, I'd be like, show me, you know, it's like, they were just like, show, you know, I'm upset.
Yeah. Like, you know, I'm like, I'm trying to like, I think about my dad, I start to shed a tear. My daughter's trying to watch Saturday morning cartoons and I'm like dapping her away. Cause I don't want to ruin her childhood. Yeah. Cause I don't remember my dad. I never turned to my dad and go, dad, have you ever seen your dad? Why are you crying, dad?
Well, he's crying. He cries now.
Now, more, but not
more,
growing up.
No, more than he ever did. But I have no problem at all crying in front of
but
my
do
kids.
Do you think your kids have a problem with it?
Probably. I don't know.
He showed his daughter the other day the scene where he got shot in the Irishman. He walked it through it frame by frame.
Oh, God.
And then, ready for this drum roll, put her to bed. It was bedtime. This wasn't even over pancakes.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, that was a mental. So speaking of movies.
Was that your first death scene?
Yeah. Yeah, that was my
first. Were you scared? That was the I had to do a death scene in a Kevin Costner film, and it was I was really scared about that because I was like, how do you die and look like you know how to act, or at least make it, you know, the editor not go fuck. Okay, this is how did you approach that, or did you...
it was a stunt guy.
Okay,
so I mean, it was me, the character. Yeah, but it wasn't me actually dying.
Okay.
But talking about movies, do you enjoy the movie making process, being a stand-up comedian? Was it an easy transition for you, or
it's like I've had both. I had experiences that I loved because it felt collaborative and it felt like the right people behind it. And then I had, you know, one experience where the director, you know, maybe didn't know my kind of humor, and so there was a little bit of like, you know, pushback. And then the editor was not a guy who maybe edited comedy. He'd had a great editing, you know, repertoire, but it wasn't. So that is frustrating because you spend a lot of time, you know, everybody's there to make each other look good and you hopefully knock it out of the park. And so nothing beats live performance. Nothing. There's nothing has met it, you know.
We have all the control,
but it's so
too
different that it's fun. It's fun to be there collaboratively with your heroes sometimes you grew up with, or people that are on the come up, and you're watching that like, that person, oh my God, they're impressing me. And so I love it. But as I build that side of my career out now, like, we just found a script. Actually, it was brought to me that was a Blacklist script some years back. You know, those are like the most kind of sought after or considered in town to be like the most like valuable stories from writers that year. And I've always wanted to produce.
What does that mean, a Blacklist script? You know what that means?
No. Yeah, if you go online, it's like the Blacklist script is every year there's the, whatever, 2024 Blacklist. And it could be 20, 30 films that are like, somebody's read all the films that are in town. And these are the ones that like should be made. They're the best writing, the best storytelling. And oftentimes like a black swan will be on the Blacklist. And that's how Aronofsky gets it. And it makes its way up, you know, hopefully to get made. And so, you know, this company comes to me, oh, we have a Blacklist script. That's always been a dream of mine. If you talk about like, what are the things that it's like, I'd love to make a great film, you know, from a great writer that's of this ilk. And so, yeah, it's like that idea of making this film, because I'm in it from the ground up. I'm in it from the very first day of like, literally yesterday they called and they go, we're making a movie. But, you know, we got a Blacklist film. It's ours. We got our budget. It's a great budget. We can get people that... And so for that reason, I love it. I don't love it for what I thought years ago, which was when I'm just the name above the thing and it's about me and I fucking just, and I have to be a certain way to please the fans. Or that came with pressure that I didn't really, I thought I liked it, but I didn't really enjoy it.
Yeah.
I enjoy more the collaborative nature of it as opposed to what does it do for the business of just Dane Cook instead of like, how can I help this so we all win.
Right,
more interesting to me.
How did you do comedies that were like a movie that's a comedy coming from stand-up where the validation is the laughter, right? And now you're on set and you're not really getting that. Like, how do you adjust to that performance? Did you have to instinctually say, oh, this is funny?
Yeah. I think I got pretty lucky because my first like leading man role was Employee of the Month in 2005.
Jessica Simpson was in
Jessica
that, right?
Simpson. Yeah. But Greg Coolidge, writer-director, was really awesome in Lionsgate because they let us put Harlan Williams in it. They let us put Andy Dick in it. They let us put Dax Shepard in it. So I was coming to work every day with people that were like, we'd lean over and be like, you're fucking killing it, man. That's great, dude. You're killing it. Like, we were all there for each other and teeing each other, especially Harlan, who's one of my best friends to this day. Mm. I come over and be like, am I any good here? Like, I'm also having to be the guy, the leading man guy. And you're like, I just want to be funny, but I get it. I have to kind of drive story.
Yeah.
But then you're like, I feel like a dud. Like, what am I, you know? Huh. And so it's cool. It's cool when you have that funny people around you to hopefully help you to figure out, you know, all right, you're in the pocket. It's good. Great producers know how to come over to and like telecast or I don't watch dailies. I don't really like to see myself in that way. But, you know, when you have good people around you, they're going to let you know, like, you know, I did do a movie years before that, very terrible, bad, very bad movie. I was at ICM in 1999 and Nick Stein, my agent at the time, called and goes, my client, they can't get the insurance for my client to travel to Nice, France. I just got you a movie co-lead. And that's the good news. You're going to live in Nice, France on the Mediterranean Sea. And what's the bad news? He goes, It's with Dennis Rodman.
Oh, I think I remember this. What was it called?
It was called Simon Says SEC.
Yes!
So good? Shut the fuck up.
Dude, that was popular.
When this movie is on in the middle of the night, I just turn off all my devices and I'm like, why is this on? No. So it's like there, and by the way, the guy that couldn't, this is true, the guy that couldn't get insured to do the movie was Robert Downey Jr. was considering doing a movie with Dennis Rodman, and because of his issues, they couldn't get him insured. So that's how good my career was and how shitty Robert Downey Jr.'s career was that I was going to do a movie, you know. Yeah, yeah. But it's that thing. So I ended up going over, and you're like, okay, I'm doing this thing that I know it's not, doesn't feel good. It's not very good. I don't feel very good in it. I don't have somebody who's really like, you know, guiding me through. But the funny thing that did happen was the director pulled me aside. Now I'm in France, and every day catering's coming around, and they have like, it's France. It's like the best foods in the world, right? And he comes over to me, is like maybe 3 weeks in. He goes, I got to talk to you for a second. And I go, what? And he goes, you got to stop with the bread. And he's like, you look 10 pounds heavier this week alone on camera. I was eating ham and cheese. I was sitting there in between scenes eating the most delicious bread with a fucking block of cheese and ham. And he literally was like, you're gaining weight in real time.
That's insane.
And John Panette was in the movie, and he was already fucking fat as a house. And you're telling me, I knew it was bad when I'm with Panette and they're like, you have to slow down. You're looking very puffy today.
Oh my God. You didn't even have to shave. The shaving wasn't even as much of an issue as the weight, right? Yeah. Oh my God. That's wow. Yeah,
but
good
food.
What an experience. Did you hang out with Rodman in fucking France?
We did.
Wow. Yeah.
I just followed him. Wherever the party was, I went.
Wow.
And it was insane. It was truly, if I write a book about that part of my life, that chapter will probably get me in the most trouble because of what I witnessed, and it was just fucking bonkers.
What a yin and yang from working with Maria Osmond to Dennis Rodman. Wow!
You know? Right?
Yeah.
Today, it's kind of like, I don't know, like today I look at it and go, man, if you can work with a great group of people that you like, there is really no better feeling in the world than driving toward a set where you're like, oh man, everybody here is enthused and ready to go. And I've always been fortunate. I'm sure you feel the same way. You too. Like, we have stand up, and that provides the opportunity. I've said no to a lot of things over the years. Over the past 10 years, I got offered a lot of comedy changed after 2011. A lot of comedies that I had made up until that point, even though I never had like a bona fide $100 million blast. I never had like a Sandler level crusher, right? But I always had doubles. You know, I always did like well, and then DVD even better. But then right after I did Best Friend's Girl, and then we hit like 2011, PC changed everything. And those kinds of movies just weren't getting made for the longest time. It wasn't until in the last couple of years, right? You know, that like finally getting Trusting Comics back in front of the camera and like the kind of comedy we want to do. It's like, I think comedy is going to be better from here on out, seemingly, the way like the landscape is and the comics that are popular and on the come up and through the Joe Rogans and the Shane Gillis. Like, I think comedy is coming back in a great way.
Yeah.
But I got offered like some tremendously shitty projects that I'm like, I want to work really bad. But if I do that, I'm fucked, because then they're going to go, he would do that. And so, as hard as it is, I'm excruciatingly patient, even though I just want to be around people and I want to work as well. But once you take the easy fish, you're like, that's all you're going to get. Yeah, so, I've been patient. I do the stand-up when I need to do the stand-up. But I feel it's a prosperous year ahead if we can get this thing going.
Boom.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What do you think about the state of comedy today in regards to the comedians that are out there opposed to 30 years ago when you were coming up? Do you think... And maybe I'm leading the witness.
I have been in a pretty major court case, Sebastian, as you may know. So.
And the comedians today have the amount of reps, do you think, that you had coming up in regards to, like, putting in the time, going to these gigs and wherever, a small, you know, performing.
Like the 10,000 hours from the road and what we had to do.
Is it there anymore, or have we just eclipsed that, and now it's, hey, you're funny on Instagram, and now you got an audience, and we're going to, you know, or do you think the cream rises, or where are we at?
Oh, boy. It's like, on one hand, yeah, it's a more entrepreneurial world. There's more entertaining people, and they'll do things like podcasts, or they'll have other ways of exploiting their abilities. But as far as like organically what stand-up is, like, there is no other way to do it than to go out there and find your voice through a lot of hollow, you know, turbulent, tough, you know, that long drive in between gigs is just as important as the good and the shitty gig.
Mm-hmm. So what was that? How many, I remember playing the Minneapolis Mall of America and killing, and then walking home through an abandoned amusement park in the mall because it's closed down. I just like, oh, you think you're having a good day? You good comic? Go underneath the Ferris wheel. And that's making me stronger than the set, right? Because if you're not going to kill yourself by the time you hit the parking lot, you'll be back for Saturday shows. And you just grow. Now it's like you said, right? Just,
but you do see like more, it's interesting because you see more diversity in comedy, which is great, and you see more people that I think are organically funny, and they've earned some kind of confidence through even like their YouTube videos or whatever that is, right? Mm-hmm. But I still think that stand-up comics and comedy, it's like at its truest form is, have you been on shows where it's like there's five popular people but they're not honed, and so you're almost like, they're laughing, but they don't know what a real comic is yet. But they're laughing. They're enjoying the show. So what does that mean for, like, this is where I'll sound like an old head or the old bull, where it's like, I just think that if you came up virtually through comedy, you've only been doing that through, that 15-year-old kid who watched a funny person do that, to them, that's comedy. Mm-hmm. And if you're that comic talking to that kid, you're just going to keep growing it differently from how we came up. I hope it's always what we did, but it is different. And I don't like the hybrid. I don't like when it's all kind of like, it's a YouTube crowd with that's it, kind of everybody stuck in one spot. It is what it is. But I just feel like, and I also feel like crowds come out and they're not even expecting you to be as good as you are, because I think that their expectations from,
absolutely.
Do you understand? Like, no,
I think you hit it on the head. Yeah. I think the expectations, it's like, I feel like everybody's eating ham and no one knows what filet tastes like.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And they come on, they see, and then suddenly you've got a showmanship and an act and the enthusiasm. And on top of just like being somebody who can gab and is interesting, you know, Judd Apatow once said in a Rolling Stone interview that I probably read late at night when I was on the computer and walking on a tread. He said in like a 94 article, why isn't he famous? He was kind of in a weird languishing time. And he goes, because I have no charisma. And Jim Carrey does. And he named it. And he almost came off a little, you know, persnickety about it. But he was like, those guys have something I don't have. And I think he was right. In that era, you had to pay in a ticket. I'm sitting here. I want that showmanship. And if the audience is just learning, oh, I just listen to you podcast and gossip and rap, and then they come out and that's all they expect, that's fine. But then you take the stage and they're like, fuck, like, this is somebody who's really thought this whole thing out, and it's not just the willy-nilly isn't the, oh, you're just a celebrity that I know from the YouTube. It's like the old Dennis Miller joke. If you put a peach on TV 24 hours a day, and then you take the peach and walk it around in a wagon, people go, that's the peach from TV. And when he said that, I was like, I don't ever want to be the fucking peach from TV.
I've never heard that. I love that.
Yeah, that's the peach from TV. And you're like, do you want somebody who's like, I get goosebumps in these conversations, man, because it's like, you just made my job a little easier, because if you're not going to put in the time, I'm still putting in the time. And I'm the best I've been ever right now, 33 years in. So when you come, you see my show with all the tools and all the now, being able to like to go inward, to share so many different, dial it up to so many different places. And it's like, I think it just makes a great comic even better, because there's a lot of flotsam and jetsam out there.
Yeah, man. Absolutely.
Have you ever thought about, what do you think about podcasting? Have you ever thought about having your own podcast? Have you had your own podcast? To my knowledge, I don't think you have, but is that something that you look around and go, everybody's got a podcast? Do you feel a pressure?
No pressure.
To have your own?
I definitely, so I've been approached to do podcasts over the years. I think after the early aughts, to be honest, I was so burnt out on tech because I did it for so long that even before a podcast, I used to do something actually called the Danecast. It was on my old website where I'd do an MP3 and upload it, and you could listen to me rant about my week. And so I was doing them before they were even like
Jesus, man.
Dude, I'm like a fucking time traveler. Yeah. It's like my wife always goes, I love the 80s. I love 80s. She's 25. She goes, I love 80s music. I'm like, I was fucking there. Oh, I was in it. I know Hall & Oates.
I feel like you're going to tell us. I used to take my pants and make leg warmers. No. I had leg warmers.
No, but so I was doing all these things. So I get a little burnt out. And so by the time all that's on the come up, you know, for right or wrong, I'm kind of like, I made it through tech. I already did all these big things that I was wanting to do.
Yeah.
But I also, like, somebody once asked me, hey, do you want to do a late night talk show? And I go, I'm not going to do it better than at the time I said, like, a Jon Stewart or like, I'm not going to do it better. And if I don't feel like I can either contribute or do something that I think is better, I don't feel like it's my place to enter in. I think there's a lot of people doing podcasts that I look at and go, unless I feel like I have something really great,
yeah,
that really feels like, oh, this is organic and Dane's loving it, I don't want to just do it for the sake of, you know what I mean? Yeah. But I feel like I should. I just don't know what that idea is.
Well, it's good enough. If you don't have the passion in that sense for that sort of thing that you're saying not to do it. But
I just don't want to do it just to do it because there's already people doing it so great that you're going to be in comparison. It's like, why don't, I'm not going to take away from them. These are the best. They, you know, they've earned that. And unless I feel like I can figure that out, it's like, not yet, but maybe, I don't know.
I got a question, if you don't mind.
No.
Before I forget. The movie with Costa, Mr. Brooks, right? Is it called more than Mr. Brooks? Or was it just called Mr. Brooks? Was there more to the title?
You missed it.
I didn't miss that.
Mr. Brooks. That was it.
Right. It was just called Mr. Brooks. All right. But I want to ask you about that movie. Like, first of all, when you did that movie, I'm like, oh my God, this guy's like on top of everything. You're doing a movie with Costa. When Costa, I know he's had the big Yellowstone thing now, but back then he was just pure movie star.
Oh yeah, man. Field of Dreams.
Now, there was that one scene, because I was thinking as a comic, where you was so scared your character pissed yourself.
Right.
Are you, because you're also a comic.
Because people are wondering, he's a serial killer, and I was really scared.
It's a dark movie.
It's very dark, like a thriller, and I am under his tutelage to kind of become a serial killer like him. But
because,
I'm scared.
Because you got a photo of him, so you almost had a blackmail situation going on as well. Right. Yeah. So at one point, I don't know if you saw the movie, but your character's so scared, you pissed yourself. And it was, you're also, at that time, a cool comic, like, you know, the girls think you're cute and this, that. So are you going at all, like, all right, I'm an artist now, or are you like, in your head, do I have to piss? Like, you're having a conversation with your manager at the time, going, can I just be scared? Do I literally have to piss myself? Because it was like, I was like, oh, Jesus. It was like, it was
between scenes where I'd already peed, had the pee on there, which they had a device, you know, to make it look like a, but then this was like the saddest part is like, it'd be like cut and then they'd have to go again and it'd dry. And you know, those old, in like an old diner, the ketchup or the mustard were in those little, somebody walk up with water and just squirt my crotch and be like, all right, let's do it one more time. So like, I'm just, you know, getting warm water squirted on my balls.
There's a comic
but I'm looking at Costner. Yeah. I'm just, it's somebody squirting me and I'm looking, and in my head, I'm like, somebody's squirting my balls and I'm fucking staring at one of my fucking heroes. And I don't know how I am here, but I'm going to enjoy
it. Well, the party going, if Matt Damon got this part, he'd be like, yeah, I'm not peeing. And they go, okay, no problem. But like, yeah, like, do you not know what you can and can't say as an actor?
First of all, for that,
or you're just locked in. I'm not a comedian right now. I'm just an actor.
No, because I auditioned for that when I was making Employee of the Month. I submitted myself on tape in my trailer, and Jeremy Plager, who at the time at CAA, took my tape and said, nobody's thinking of you for this, and they're already thinking of these three names. I'm driving this to Costner's house, and I'm going to tell him to watch it. And so Jeremy Plager is the reason that I have any kind of dramatic career.
Man.
Costner calls me in Albuquerque and goes, I remember the first thing he said, you know, Dane Costner, blah, blah, blah. I go, hey, man. He goes, you're really serious about this, huh? You really put a lot of effort into this. And I was like, I really am. And I quickly gave my, you know, 10-cent tour of how I saw the character and the part. He goes, I'll see you in Shreveport. And so when I got there, I got it. Yeah, on the phone. He goes, you want to come? William Hurt, me, Demi Moore. I didn't even know William Hurt or Demi Moore. He tells me on there, he goes, I got Demi Moore, William Hurt, me, you. I will see you in Shreveport.
And she's still married to Bruce, who might be hanging at some point, right?
The whole thing was an amazing experience going there, but I'm in great shape. I'm doing the thing where it's like I'm trying to be like, you know, the comedy guy, and I'm leaning into what I know is that kind of image and all that shit. But also, like, I'm coming off that movie where I'm in good shape for Employee of the Month. I get to Shreveport. There's a Chick-fil-A next to my hotel. I start pouring Polynesian sauce. I gain 30 pounds in the month of rehearsal because I just want to look like a fucking shit. I already have a big fucking Irish head. I got acne scars from when I'm a kid. I tell him no makeup. I tell Costner, I go, I don't want any makeup. I want to look like this fucking, like, whatever you want me to do, like, I'm here, use me in any way that you want. So he was like, dude, you came here ready to, in fact, we were texting about it a month ago, Kevin and I, because it was the 15-year anniversary, and we still talk about that scene right there, the graveyard scene.
If you touch even a hair in my head, the cops are going to find those pictures. And they're going to know that you killed that couple.
The contents of your safety deposit box, Mr. Smith, have vanished.
Help me!
Oh, wow. He fucked me up. I had one take to die. We're in a graveyard at 3 a.m. There are actual tarantulas on the ground. There's actual fucking spiders this big that they couldn't clear. And every time I fell, they would fucking come towards me. Yeah. Shreveport's full of fucking tarantulas, man. Yeah.
Wow,
yeah,
man.
Dude, I mean, like, this is the stuff that, you know, we dream about, you know, when we're watching John Ritter fucking flip over a couch. And you're like, maybe me someday. Maybe I get the call.
And then it was when you're awesome, going to six, you can show that scene.
That's show, awesome, show man. My daughter that before bed some night.
Yeah. Wow, man.
Yeah.
So that's a total... Was it dark? Because that was such a dark movie for Costner. Was the scene, was the set, was it like gloom and doom? Were people having fun off set, like chatting?
It was amazing, man. Every time it was cut, it was him and I, and he'd grab me and be like, come on, they're going to relight. And I would just sit with him, and he'd be like... you know, Gene Hackman and I was, and all of a sudden I was just like this. Wow. And he loved to talk. And Kevin's a good friend of mine. He's a philosopher. He's a very thoughtful guy. I mean, I feel like that was probably everything that happened to me during that time, personally and professionally. Like, I was a different person when I left that production. I treated my business different from things that I learned from him and things that he expected of me. But the coolest thing that I will tell you is there's a scene in that movie where him and I are driving in the car, and he turns to me before we're filming and he goes, I want to, can we do some improv? And I go, yeah. And he goes, yeah, let's do some improv. Let's just be in character. Let's talk about the other killing that we did. Blah, blah, blah. And suddenly we're just, and William Hurt's in the back seat. His character is like a figment of cause. So he's sitting there, William Hurt's watching us. And for about 8 minutes, they roll on Kevin and I, and we're just like free. Like, I never done improv. I'd done improv my whole life in comedy, but now I'm improvising this stuff that's real, you know, menacing and just, I'm a delinquent and I'm just coming up with this stuff. And then Kevin just grabbed me. He was like, let's just get, this is awesome. And he was so excited that it made me like, dude, I'm like, wow. Like, he's happy that I'm here. Yeah, I'm not just here. He's like, you're teeing me up. Keep teeing me. That's it. And so they ended up using that whole piece in the movie. He called me up because we're not even using the beginning of that scene. We're using what you and I did improvising. Wow. And you see William Hurt's reacting. And I mean, honestly, man, it's like if they took my entertainment's license after that production, you'd have to go, all right.
Yeah.
I've done some cool shit.
I know you talked about this a lot, and then we'll let you go after this. And I want to talk to you about, you know, you've told the story so many times about your brother taking money from you and whatnot. But after that experience, do you feel like you have a hard time trusting people, or is that just a one-off? And
that's a good question.
Dane's open for business now.
Yeah.
Or are you like, what the fuck does this person want?
Well, it's the question I think. You know, people that are aware of what I experienced. My brother was my business manager. He's my older brother. He's my only brother. I grew up with him. And I loved him. He was my best friend. And he was actually a person who probably in that time when I was so trepidatious and scared as a kid, more often than not, put his hand on my back and said, you got it. You can do this. I've been filming a documentary the last year and a half with a company that came to me. We got a company came out of Canada. We got a great grant. And for the last year and a half, I'm telling the whole story. Mm. And so without getting too much into it, because even like legally, I can't keep going there, but I can say this. What we have put together is going to probably answer a lot of these questions and also really let people know what how dark and how scary it got, because it wasn't just you know, it wasn't just the theft, it wasn't just the betrayal, it was something far more evil that was happening behind the scenes with my brother that we didn't know till we were really getting the doc going. So I hope when it comes out,
do we have a release date on this thing yet?
Probably by the fall.
Yeah,
so by the fall. But you saying until we were getting the doc going? So there is a part of me that like you're already making it based on what happened.
Yeah,
and then you found that this other evil thing. You're like, yeah, it's terrible that happened, but oh my god, this is so good for the doc.
We're making. Yes. Yes. That's now we're thinking. I'm gonna get you a little trend. And then we go. Just commiserating. No. I can truly say, I can kind of answer the question to say, like, I can tell the story now, Sebastian, because I actually am better from it. You know, when somebody in your life is, let's just say, toxic, but you don't know. But then that person's removed, even if it's just like ripped away. At first, the betrayal and a lot of things, like it really, you know, put me in like the undertow. I was really like, I couldn't believe it. But once he was out of my life, it was like this, I could breathe. I didn't even know how much, you know, negativity, you know, was around me from things that he had, you know, kind of like drummed up or things that. So to be able to look at it now and tell a story that if we do our job right, I say this like half jokingly, if we do our job right, when it ends up hopefully on a streamer, it's like under comedy and true crime, because it is very funny.
Oh,
it focuses on that time in my life. So I get to put a little bit of like, here's what's happening with me, you know, the funny and the, you know, the little bit of the behind the scenes. Sorry. But then once you get into the nuts and bolts of what he did to my family, what he did to me, it's pretty grim, you know, and it starts to go to a place where you're like, I hope there's a laugh coming, because it does take you on kind of a, I don't think there's a comedy tragedy story like this ride where it's like, it really is very funny and there's a lot of things that are appealing, but then it's like, I think people will watch and be like, first of all, I didn't know that this happened to me, and will understand me a little more, but hopefully somebody else who goes through it will be able to be like, dude, if he can make it through what that was, then hopefully I can, you know, keep my eye on the prize too. So I can't wait for people to see it.
Bro, if that was the trailer for the documentary, right? Can't fucking wait for this thing. Right?
Me too.
Look, you're praying.
What? I'm wondering, is there any chance you could get, would you try to get your brother on it? Like,
I can't talk about that, but you're asking very good questions. I can't speak to who is a part of it yet, but.
Okay, see.
But I think if you know me, the one thing you know is I like to be in the holy shit business. And if I can make you go holy shit, then I will be very happy.
Jesus fucking Christ, guys.
Wow.
Dane Cook.
Very pleased.
Here today.
Very pleased to be here.
Very, very pleased. Oh, my God. Well, thanks, bro.
Yeah, oh, dude, thank you, man. And again, thank you. And I have to say, congratulations, man, on everything you've accomplished. You are one of the reasons where comedy is today, and where a lot of young people look and go, man, like, I want to have my moment where I feel like I'm at my proudest. I hope that you can really look at what you've accomplished and realize it's really inspirational, man. And Pete, good to see you.
Me too, bro. I was going to watch you doc, but now I'm not. Because I'm a wanderer. Yeah, a wanderer.
The show has ended.
And he literally was like, you're gaining weight in real time.
That's insane.
And John Panette was in the movie. And he was already fucking fat as a house. And you're telling me...